Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Podcast of Things after a long hiatus. I'm here with the best co-podcasters. This is the Students Against Mass Incarceration episode of the Podcast of Things. I'm Jake Lohr, as you all know, one of the co-founders of SAMI, and here are the others.
I'm Anna Grant Bolton, also a co-founder of SAMI.
I'm Luca.
I'm Reese, also a co-founder of SAMI, as well as Luca.
So Reese and Anna have been on the pod before, but maybe we can start by
saying a little bit.
Sorry, Anna and Luca have been on the pod before. Reese is making their debut. So maybe we can say a little bit more about ourselves. You know, I'm a political science major, planning on going to law school after college. We all graduate soon. We're all seniors. Anna?
I'm a human rights and public policy double major, and I'm going on to get my master's in social work on a policy track after college.
I'm Reese, and I'm an English major. And as of right now, my plan is to move to Chicago with Anna. And probably get a cat and a job, hopefully.
And hopefully Jake and Luca, too.
Sure. TBD, TBD.
We're lobbying, full court press.
Yeah, I'm also a poli sci major. And I don't know what comes next, so we'll see. But it is crazy we're graduating soon.
Also TBD. Yeah, it is crazy. So this is the crew that in the spring of 2023 founded Students Against Mass Incarceration on Trinity's campus, full circle. Does anyone want to tell the story of how SAMI got off the ground?
Well, I feel it begins with us, right?
It does begin with you.
I would say so. So all of us took Professor Terwiel's Prisons and Justice in America class, and I was actually – I sat next to Jake in that class freshman year.
Yes, indeed.
Fall semester. And we were discussion partners. And so that's how I got to know Jake. And then it gets kind of fuzzy.
When did you take it, Anna?
I also took it freshman year, but in a different section.
I see.
Yeah.
And then I took it that same spring of sophomore year.
And then one fateful day in the spring of sophomore year, while Luca was taking the class, I had also been a research assistant for Professor Terwiel on her book about prison abolition. And we were doing food recovery, actually, with the Trinity Community Care Project, one of the other organizations that Anna Grant Bolton here runs. And so essentially what we did was take the leftover food from our school's dining hall and bring it to local homeless shelters. And on that day, essentially, the idea for SAMI was birthed. And ever since then,
I remember it was on the way back in the community service van.
Yeah, I thought it was on the way there.
It could have actually been on the way. But we were like, you know, talking about how we were all in the class and saying, you know, like, this work is great. Like, why doesn't there exist a club, which is like Students Against Mass Incarceration? And then from that point, I was like, we should make one.
Yeah.
Although we didn't actually know the name. We were brainstorming.
Yeah. And I think a big part of the reason that we all felt compelled to start the club is because we were all quite passionate about, like, addressing the injustice that we had kind of learned about in classes. And we all kind of come to it with, like, a different background. Like, Anna had been super involved with activism in her hometown but like it was my first time learning about it in
mine
class
as well.
And so I think we were all just like very moved by the class, and we thought that there was kind of a gap between like how much learning was being done and how much action was being done. So we wanted to make space on campus for people to get involved with combating mass incarceration.
Also, you know, like reflecting on how much we had learned from that class, and like for me, and I know for all of us, it was like quite eye-opening how like it would benefit other like Trinity students to like learn about this. So we wanted to raise awareness as well as like try to make a direct impact in the community.
And I think even beyond the class, you know, I think by the time it was spring of our sophomore years, we were also discussing this topic so often, like based on what we had learned. We were discussing the injustices around us in Hartford that had to do with the criminal legal system and discussing the broader philosophy of it. And I think we realized, you know, we were doing so much learning and discussing about mass incarceration, but we were doing very little action on it.
Yeah, by the way, you guys have a great podcast on similar discussions.
So true.
Before,
we do.
Right?
Yeah.
So for those who want to look back on that, you can.
As a reference point, this is kind of the sequel. Yeah, good plug, Luca. Luca. So I feel like since then, Sammy has done so many cool things. Maybe we can start by discussing kind of where we are today before we maybe get back into like the middle of it and, you know, some of the philosophical and organizing questions of Students Against Mass Incarceration.
Yeah, almost but 2 years later, too.
Almost 2 years later, yeah. But
Sammy's birthday.
Sammy's birthday, I know. Maybe. Toddler, the terrible twos.
If we have a photo, we could, like, actually celebrate it, like, if we can figure out what day it was.
Yeah. Sammy we should birthday. Be able to find that, the yeah. Sammy yeah. birthday. But, yeah, so essentially the way that Sammy's set up is that we have three main branches of the organization. We focus on direct aid, which is, you know, directly helping those in our community who are affected or at risk of being affected by the criminal legal system and racialized mass incarceration. There's political education, which is kind of what Luca is talking about, spreading the word on campus and hopefully opening others' eyes in the same way that our eyes were opened. And then also policy advocacy, which is targeted at addressing the structural, systemic, and legislative components that perpetuate mass incarceration in Connecticut. And I think all of which we've gained a lot of traction on. Any like highlights of Sammy's events that y'all are most proud of?
I think, unless you wanted to go in.
Go for it.
Something that's pretty like, I think it's cool that it's now an annual thing is our coat drive. And that's like a pretty big beginning of the year event. We set out these bins all over campus and we get people to donate clothes that are donated to community partners in action. What's the reentry welcome center of community partners in action. And so I just think it's a fun time putting together. We always have like a meeting that where we make the posters for the event, and I think it's just like a good community bonding thing. And of course it's just like a whole lot of fun. And then this year we were able to make it a part of Winterfest, which was like a collaboration with a bunch of clubs, and we got a lot of a lot of traffic, and it's just nice to see people out and about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like going off that, I was also going to say the clothing drive, but I think some of my favorite things are like the annual things that we do, like kind of making things that seem like almost like a tradition going forward, which hopefully, you know, because we're all graduating, will stick, and we can look back and like see some of the same things that we've been doing, as well as like, you know, branching out and doing new things that we haven't thought of before, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of those recurring things that we do that are really cool are each Sunday we go to Bushnell Park, which is a local park near us. It's actually right by the Connecticut State Capitol building. And we basically take food from our Mather Dining Hall and redistribute it to people, typically people who are unhoused at Bushnell Park, with an organization called Food Not Bombs, which is a really cool space. You know, their mantra is solidarity, not charity, and it does definitely feel like that, because we don't just drop off the food. It's kind of the work is about standing there and hanging out and talking to people in your community, getting to know your neighbors. So I think that's one of the really cool things that we started doing last semester that I'm quite proud of too.
Another thing that I feel proud of, and I feel like this is a way that we've grown a lot since when we first started, is collaborating with organizations doing work kind of at the intersections of mass incarceration and other systems of injustice, and trying to understand, kind of as Jake was saying earlier, that a lot of the same people oppressed by mass incarceration are the same people, you know, with lack of access to food, are the same people who were under threat of deportation. So like doing things like Food Not Bombs, we've also been working with Hartford Deportation Defense, helping out with childcare at their trainings and things like that. And then also we've been quite involved in supporting the divestment movement on campus. We've had several organizers from SAMI who've been quite involved in creating the presentation for the Board of Trustees on divestment, planning rallies. And for those who don't know, divestment is a movement. It's very big on college campuses right now, but it's a movement to try to get universities and colleges to take money out of their endowment investments, take all of the endowment investments that are invested in systems of human rights violations and injustice. So, for example, militarism, apartheid, genocide, it's really come to a head.
And mass incarceration.
Yeah, it's really come to a head in with calls for divestment from Israel and Israeli apartheid and genocide, but also mass incarceration and also weapons manufacturing more broadly. So I think something that I feel like we've been trying to be intentional about in the past, and I want to I'm excited to see how we continue to do it in the future under new leadership, is thinking about how we can collaborate with organizations, people's movements, doing really important work at the edges of mass incarceration, at the borders, at these intersection points, so that we can not only, you know, address some of the issues that feed into mass incarceration, but also build a more inclusive, stronger, wider movement.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's something that's interesting. I'd like to hear all y'all's thoughts on this. But something that's interesting is, like, part of what we do when we go to Food Not Bombs, for example, or when we do a lot of work also volunteering at the soup kitchen that's a couple blocks away at a homeless shelter, a couple blocks away from our college campus called the Mercy House. And, you know, like, I think a lot of people's first thought is, what does this have to do with mass incarceration, essentially working in homeless shelters or helping distribute food to the community? And I hope that precisely, you know, what we're trying to, like, illuminate by that work is that breaking down this barrier between Trinity College and the invisible and real walls that separate us from the, you know, the Hartford community that is very much a space of concentrated poverty and is mostly inhabited by people of color, whereas Trinity College is a predominantly white institution that is extremely affluent, that doesn't pay property taxes. And I think breaking down those barriers while also kind of illuminating the fact that hunger and homelessness and economic insecurity are really at the heart of mass incarceration is kind of the goal, both from a political education standpoint, but of course also from a direct aid that hopes to mitigate some of that through this kind of supportive measures. But it is interesting because maybe we don't do a good enough job of, like, talking about that. I wonder if some people think, like, oh, why is Sammy distributing food? What does this have to do with mass incarceration? What are y'all's thoughts?
Yeah. I guess, like, when you were saying people wonder, like, what does this have to do with mass incarceration? I guess, like, my first thought was, like, it has everything to do with mass incarceration, because it's just, like, it feels like most of the reason people end up in prisons, and usually, like, I don't know, it's just, like, unjustifiably because, like, people, like, lack things. It's usually, like, a lack of something, whether it be, like, food or housing or just, like, community. And I think, like, that kind of work is, like, we're addressing, like, the root problem, especially as, like, that's kind of, like, what is, like, in our kind of, like, capacity, especially as, like, college students. It's, like, the least we can do and also some of the most important work we can do, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Mm-hmm. I think, and then one more, we'll circle back to this, but one of the more interesting philosophically and morally things that we do too in terms of direct aid is we work with a group called One Standard of Justice, helping people through the pardon and parole process. So, like you say, you know, pardons and paroles are, I guess we don't do much parole, but the pardon process is obviously extremely intertwined with mass incarceration, because these are people who have been incarcerated, served prison sentences, are now back in the community, but continue to have a record that inhibits their ability to obtain housing or food or employment. So that's more clear. But as you said, Reese, I think that actually, in fact, part of what we want to do is illuminate that these root causes that we can deal with, hopefully, but in any way we can, what little we can through food and solidarity and things like that in the community, are equally, if not more important, which is kind of interesting part of the conversation about like the criminal justice system that kind of is obscured by maybe an overly narrow focus on mass incarceration itself.
Yeah, and that kind of gets at an interesting point in that's really central to the movement for decarceration, and I'll just define decarceration quickly for folks who haven't heard that word before. I know it's new to me a few years ago, but essentially decarceration is the word for the movement to end mass incarceration and build up systems to support people and support people's needs while we're dismantling mass incarceration. And so the point that I guess I'm trying to make here is that this additional work that we do is about like kind of building up new systems of care, strengthening new systems of care. And that work is like deeply intertwined with the work of dismantling mass incarceration, reducing the footprint of the prison and jail and policing system. Because it's really, and we've had these conversations so many times, us four, it's really not enough just to get rid of prisons and jails, to shut them all down, or shut the vast majority of them down. Like, a lot of the work is making sure that people's immediate needs are met so that they don't, so that there is not this imposed scarcity that creates violence. And so I think that's something that's really important that I think we're all trying to do a better job of emphasizing, that's oftentimes left out of the movement for decarceration, is it's as much about construction and building networks of care as it is about dismantling mass incarceration.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I wonder, I mean, we should give actually like a little overview of what mass incarceration really is and what racialized, how it's racialized, but we can get to that a little bit later. I think we can wrap up kind of talking about the cool stuff we do. But one of the things that we do is we show like films. So we've watched Sing Sing, we've watched 13th, we've watched Just Mercy. I wonder what you all think about the efficacy of that form of political education in a place where, you know, of course we're doing direct aid alongside it, but you might wonder, what is the point of showing movies about carceral facilities or about policing?
Sorry, y'all. I have thoughts. I have two thoughts. So one, I believe it's Angela Davis. Well, yeah, who says prisons don't disappear social problems, they disappear people. And she also talks about in her book, Are Prisons Obsolete? The fact that as much as prisons appear natural and common sense, we really don't think about them. We don't think about what it's like to live in a prison. We don't think about what it's kind of materially like, experientially like to live in prison, to go to jail, to be taken away.
To cut in like very briefly, it's like it's almost like we're told that we shouldn't want to know what a prison looks like, because it's like that would signal that like, oh, I'm in the prison and I've done something wrong.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I think like one of the values that it has is it just makes like the experience of living in prison visible to people. And then the other thing that it does is like it really resists this idea that people in prison are disposable. I think a lot of the people on Trinity's campus, and certainly not all of the people on Trinity's campus, but a lot of the people have never met someone who has been incarcerated and talked to them about that experience. Almost certainly we've all met incarcerated people and or formerly incarcerated people and we haven't known it, but a lot of people I know before I came to college, I had never spoken with someone who had been incarcerated about their incarceration. And it's really like really central to what allows mass incarceration to continue, I believe, is like this idea that innately people who are incarcerated are different. They're disposable in a way that I am not. And I believe that very few of us would ever articulate that or think that consciously. But I think that if we took seriously that everyone's just as much of a human being as us that's in prison, we would never let mass incarceration churn the way that it does. So I think that one of the really powerful things about movies, it may appear to be like fluff from the outside, from people being like, oh, they're not actually doing real political education work. But it allows us to resist the disposability of people in prison, especially for people who do not have like direct contact with the carceral system. And it allows us to do it in a way that doesn't make formerly incarcerated people like re-traumatize themselves or do the emotional labor of talking about prison. Which can be really painful.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said, Anna. I think the movies we do there, for me, I think they're really, they can be really powerful because, you know, learning about these things in a classroom environment or being told, like, from an intellectual standpoint, intellectualizing these issues, you know, it has its purpose, it's important, you need to understand, like, it's helpful to learn and understand what's going on, but I think also kind of merging that intellectual learning with like a emotional aspect can be really important because like you said, it, you know, it's humanizing you. You get more mm-hmm. of a connection. Like, these are human individuals. These are people, you know, that are facing certain, like, you know, conditions and going through a lot of hardship. Yeah. And I think that, you know, those movies, like the movies or the documentaries you watch, can be really emotional. And I think just having that emotional aspect to merge with the intellectual can, like, bridge and kind of help, you know, absolutely. An understanding.
Yeah, and also, on like a more broad level, I guess, I think they're also, it's like very accessible. It's yeah. a very accessible form of learning. And I just like, I can recognize that those meetings are more well attended than a lot of like other ones, or like people yeah. who don't normally show up to SAMU show up to those ones. So
for
it's
like good quality movies.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. So I think it's also, well, we can get to that in the,
yeah.
Yeah, it's just like accessible, and like I think that's also like, you know, welcoming people into the space and like the movement. And it's like, you don't need to be a brilliant like poli sci or human rights
right,
major,
a theorist or statistician,
yes,
yeah.
to be a part of SAMI. But you can just be someone who like maybe enjoys movies, and,
right?
Like, maybe that's what sparks your passion,
right? And that's
or
good
compassion.
For coalition building. And I think, you know, too, there's a like exactly what you said. I'm big on the common sense that prisons and policing hold in our society as just like the obvious answer to everything. And I think that, you know, when Luca was talking about the emotional aspect, there's a degree to which a movie, even though it's an anecdotal, oftentimes a fiction or, you know, a take on a true story that isn't completely, you know, completely accurate of what happened, can be so much more powerful for unsettling that common sense to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is that, like, I can tell you that the U.S. at its peak of mass incarceration had 5% of the world's population but 25% of the world's prisoners. And to some people that's jarring, but to some people it's just another number in the soup of numbers that they're all hearing. But when you really sit down to watch a movie that humanizes the people that are supposedly disposable behind the prison walls, or showcases, you know, the reality of policing and its like gray fuzziness and the injustice that's embedded into that, it problematizes the idea that it's of just like good and bad, right and wrong, good people, bad people, in a powerful way that I think not everything else can. Mm-hmm. So what else about SAMI do we do that's cool? That I feel like that's direct aid. We're now moving into political education.
Yeah, so I was gonna kind of go off of what you were saying, like, you know, some things I wrestle with is like, you know, these things are, of course, very important, and there is a lot to be said about, like, raising awareness and the effect that that has, like, to use your favorite term, like, challenging carceral logics, you know?
Yeah,
like,
it's huge. It's huge.
You know, but one thing wrestling is, like, someone who says, like, what actually comes out of, you know, we discussed a little bit in terms of, like, trying to address root issues. Like, when you said, Reese, it has everything to do with mass incarceration. But, like, there, I feel like there's still, and sometimes I find myself thinking, like, it's such a daunting issue, and like really like what happens if we do all of these direct aid things? Is there another area in which we can like challenge mm-hmm. it on in terms of like a legal sphere? Because I think a lot of people think like, ah, you know, nothing's gonna happen unless we, you know, change the laws. And that is something, of course, with our policy advocacy that we try to address. But I think that is one area that like we're working to get more robust. I know we've had a lot of good things come with our policy proposal on yeah. just fees. I don't know if you guys want to talk a little bit about that, but
yeah.
you know, that side of things, you know, is always something that can be worked on, and that comes with building relationships with organizations such as like the CATALS and other organizations who do similar work, mm-hmm. ACLU, for example. But you know, it's always a work in progress, but yeah. we have done some things in that regard.
We have, and it sounds like part of what you're saying too is that like political education is a good. Is important political work to be doing even when policy advocacy isn't working right. at changing the laws per se. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be frank, like we've had, I think, based on being an organization of college students, we've had a lot of success in policy advocacy. But if we're realistic, like we haven't changed much through that avenue because of the nature of state politics. We've drafted yeah. some really important policy proposals to end the criminalization of poverty and to ensure, hopefully, you know, that people who are incarcerated in Connecticut are, you know, paid wages that represent their dignity as human beings, that adhere to legal standards, that are at least commensurate with the essentials like soap and shampoo that they have to buy for regular prices, given that these are folks who are making 30 cents an hour, oftentimes $30 a month, a dollar a day from people that I know at the Hartford jail at least. And I think that this is really important, and this is really the systemic work that we want to be doing, because it is true that the legal system, when people are accused of crimes, is extracting all this wealth from the already most impoverished segments of society who are bound up with the carceral system by, you know, having them pay for fingerprinting and pay for witness testimony and paying for DNA. And this ultimately tends to fall upon loved ones, friends and families, social networks of people who were accused of committing crimes. And ultimately what you're left with is more and more wealth and resources and time and emotional labor extracted from the communities that need to hold on to that at the most. And so it's a really vicious cycle. But, you know, we've sent this policy proposal out. The House Majority Leader of Connecticut has looked at it a couple of times and taken it pretty seriously, I would say, at least on the level of his rhetoric. You know, we've had it looked at by a lot of the governor's top policy advisors and the Undersecretary of Human Health, the Undersecretary of Criminal Justice. And so, yes, it's gained a lot of traction with both legislators and, you know, professionals in the policy sphere in the governor's office, the executive branch. But at the same time, like, it's gone nowhere. Like, we haven't gotten a bill drafted on it. We haven't had a public hearing. We haven't had testimony. And there's a question of, like, can we really enact systemic policy change as a student-led organization? The answer would hopefully be yes, you know, for us to be able to provide this research and let politicians take it and run with it. But ultimately, at least in Connecticut state politics, that's not how it works. And because we don't have the time to be constantly lobbying, it feels like, you know, that's one sphere that perhaps we have, like, less impact maybe than direct aid and political education. I don't know if y'all agree with that assessment, but we can circle back to that in general. Do you have thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I think I'm kind of the mind that when it comes to policy advocacy, like, I do think we're limited in terms of, like, time, you know, yeah. Just in, like, a very literal sense, college students have, like, odd schedules that oftentimes don't align with the odd schedules of the government. And so that's, like, a real challenge that we face. And I think, like, if we're talking candidly about where Sammy is and where Sammy wants to go, I think, like, that's the biggest gap that we've talked about is policy advocacy. And so, yeah, I think, like, part of trying to be a better organization is, like, acknowledging our limitations, but also, like, our weaknesses. And I think policy advocacy, we've invested a lot of time and energy there, but I think we've yet to, kind of make the inroads that we've wanted to, both, like, at the Capitol, but also with the organizations doing really important advocacy work. We haven't been able to develop those relationships as much as we've wanted to. So,
yeah. I mean, I think it is important, the work we've done putting these sorts of issues on the agenda, because when they're discussed in the Capitol, when they're on legislators' mind, I think that has a very real impact. In Connecticut, you know, they call it the land of steady habits, and they say bills take years and years from being pitched to introduced to finally being passed. And I think that's true, and I think there's merit to that as someone who's worked in the Connecticut legislature. But at the same time, like, what change has that enacted for real people? And I think that one of the things I love most about Sammy and is that people aren't here for it to be a resume builder. People are here because they really care about doing the work and they care about the community. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I do often wrestle with is kind of this dichotomy, because sometimes I worry, right? Like, if we're not creating systemic legal change, even if we're giving people food on Sundays or Tuesdays and Thursdays, even if we are, you know, doing political education, even if we're helping people through the pardon process, if we're not able to actively change these structures, like, what do we hope to achieve through Sammy is, like, my first question to pose to you all. And then the second question is there a degree to which, like, it ends up being more beneficial to us than the community? You know, it kind of – there's a way in which it serves as a springboard to other things, right? I know Sammy is a big part, of course, of the reason that I was accepted to many cool law schools and good law programs where I'll be going next year. The same is true for Anna. who's going to a very prestigious social work program next year. And the same will be true for you too when you when you're doing your work. Sammy will be an important part of your resume and your repertoire. And as will Reese and I have also tutored at the Hartford Jail through the Writing Center. And I just started today tutoring at York Women's Prison. But these are all sorts of things that I think are meaningful for people. But sometimes I wonder, like, are we getting more out of this for our lives than we really are giving back to the community ultimately? Not by choice. I would never assume that was anyone's intention. But does that become the result?
Yeah, because it can totally be unintentional. And I think that's such a good question, Jake, because this is like a big kind of question that we talked about. Anna and I were in like the same Gateway freshman year, like Gateway class. It was kind of like, it was called Community Action. And basically the whole class is about how do we ethically kind of like engage with the community, especially as kind of college students. And I think to answer your question in a roundabout way, I guess it's like, I know you just said like, no one here is really here for resume building, but it does in fact like build your resume.
Right.
I think the way I kind of think about it is kind of one of the most important parts about or what I took away from the experience in Community Action and also just like being a person who's like working with people is like, it's really about just like treating people really, I don't know, kindly and also it being reciprocal. It's like, as long as you're not kind of, I don't know, viewing the community as like a place of deficit, I think the work can be done and it doesn't inherently mean, or if not inherently, it's just like no ill intentions, plus a lot of like consciousness about how we're interacting with people, I think is a good recipe for like reciprocal relationships. And I would argue that like our relationships with community partners are very reciprocal. I think another big part about working with community organizations is kind of like longevity and showing that you're like invested in them as organizations and that you're not, it's not just like, you know, it's not a resume builder. It's not, we're doing this one-off event just to like do something and show people that we're doing things with Sammy. It's like, we're building relationships with people. We're getting to know people in the organizations. And I think while it does like bring skills like to us, it's not like we went out searching for the skills, if that makes sense. So I don't think it's like, it is. And I think especially to you and Anna, it's like, this is like your life's work. It's not like a mistake that the place you're going or the, your future where you want to go has to do with the things that you did in college, you know?
Right.
Obviously like Luca and I aren't on like a track specifically right now, but I'm sure it will inform the way we move through the world. And it's not that we did it. Like it's, again, that doesn't fully answer your question.
Right. Well, that's one important answer to the question is like, we will all use this on a resume to hopefully go out in the world and do more good. But I did want you to clarify really quickly, Luca, I know you have a thought. What did you mean by refraining or avoiding looking at communities as like a place of deficit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's just kind of like, it's not that like the community is suffering and we're like the people helping, or like we're helping, but we're not like the saviors or the, I guess that kind of, it's like, we're not the reason that things like are better, I guess. It's like the organizations who already live and work here, who we're collaborating with, whose work we're supporting, I think a lot of this time. And I know not all of our, I guess like events and things are like community based, but I think that's like kind of like where my mind goes when I'm thinking about like the ethics of things, because I don't know, like hosting on-campus events is obviously like applicable to resumes and things, but the largest thing I think about is like working with organizations and things like that. So
absolutely.
And I think this is a really good question, and it's related to another thing that I know we've kind of talked about, which is like, you know, you think about, well, as the college students we are from the backgrounds that we have, like, to what extent do people looking at us, Sammy, as since we are the leader of Sammy, like, well, what do these people know about it? You know, because we don't necessarily have the direct experience or have been like directly affected by the issues we're dealing with. And you know, I do wonder sometimes, like even at the club fairs, like earlier in the year, like if we were had direct experience or, you know, representing the populations that like have are impacted more directly, like to what extent would we have more a different appeal or draw different people into the organization? I know that's something we've talked about, but I think, you know, at the end of the day, we just need to, you know, prioritize the like you were saying, the other community organizations, and just learn as much as we can and try our best to just, you know, address. I don't know if you guys want to say anything.
Well, no, it's just that. It's a great point, because it's the fine line between like white saviorism or just even like affluent saviorism, being college kids at Trinity, and like not doing anything, right? Because then it should be, you know, we're not the ones most affected. We should really center the communities. We're just not going to do anything then. So it's like, how do you – because I think it's clear, like there's a clear answer that we should continue doing this work, and it's obviously very important. But it's also important not to have the deficit mindset where we're going to give and save the day. And so like I think that's the question of, you know – how are we helping in ways that are building power instead of just building our resumes, which are hard to do because we're such a student organization.
But that's why I think also, like, to go back to your point, Reese, like building relationships with like those people who are directly affected and the community itself and those other organizations who do work with the community, and just kind of using them as guideposts and learning and offering our help in any way we can and kind of just learning from them. Yeah. I think that's a great way to kind of go about it, because that's the best we can do, you know. People, if you want to get involved, like just offer a helping hand basically from those who know, you know, what's the best way to proceed.
And we all need to think of like each other as part of the same community, like global community, where we're helping each other, not just that like, oh, we're going to save this community, but rather these are our neighbors and my future is implicated in their liberation.
Yeah, there's that great quote, if you've come here to help me, then you're wasting your time. But if you've come here because your liberation is bound up in mine, then let us work together. And I think that, like, that is really the way that we try to approach community partnerships. And I know we've, like, failed at times in the past. Like, I think that's kind of the nature of doing community work, is, like, you mess up, you fail, you fall on your face, you do better next time. Like, you work to reduce the harm. And, yeah, like, community work is, like, messy and hard. But I think that, like, approaching it with the posture of, like, learning from other people and, you know, decentering yourself is, like, really a big part of it. And I think that means sometimes, like, not doing the work that's, like, flashy or exciting. Like, sometimes we'll be able to, like, you know, testify for like a bill or something like that. But like something that we've been doing a lot of recently is like doing childcare for Hartford Deportation Defense. And that's like a lot less flashy, you know, but it's like, I think, equally important. And like both of them come from people close to the issue saying, this is what I need. This is how you can help. And like our role is to say like, okay, we're going to do what we can to help in that way, you know? And so like letting communities define, letting the people most affected define like what they need from us, I think is like a really big part of it, as opposed to going in and imposing what we think we need to do to end mass incarceration. And instead, begin with the partnership, begin with the relationship building, and from there, be willing to kind of like be flexible and take on different roles, and like know that that flexibility is also gonna like help develop the relationship, but also give us like different skills that we can use in the future. And I think that that's the way like to build more ethical long-term community partnerships. It's like based on this idea of respect for the community and understanding that they have the best idea of what liberation looks like to them. And so being able to see that, like, it's within my best interest as well to learn from you, and, like, let's work and fight this system together. So, like, I think having this model of, like, equal, mutually beneficial partnerships is really important. But it's also important to, like, decenter yourself. And, like, that's the way that I've learned, is just by listening to other people who know more than me.
Yeah, well said. And I think, what for me, at least, one of the things that I, you know, value most in Sammy is like how it kind of is a place where I can like listen and like learn, and like just to, you know, listen and learn from the people like around me that we're engaging with, and then from that, like, how can I offer a helping hand? And just kind of like, you know, it's learning through the process, because, you know, that's something that's really important.
Right, as opposed to having like a blueprint or vision that you're like, all right, I'm going to do this by step one, two, and three. I think it's a good point. And I do think that, like, you know, especially in all of our cases, like, I am troubled by the accrual of power that we get, the accrual of power, prestige, opportunity that we get by doing this. But at the same time, I think that's kind of natural based on like the socioeconomic order that we have right now. And like, practically speaking, what is the answer to that? Like, because ultimately, if we don't do these things, we're going to have a similar status and power in society regardless. So like, what can we do but try to, you know, give some of that back or use some of that privilege towards more socially just ends? Mm-hmm. All right. So let's pivot a little bit. I'm curious to know, you know, we're all going to different places. We all come from different backgrounds. We're all going into different careers. We'll be in different parts of the country, except for Reese and Anna, and maybe Jake and Luca. We'll see. But what is your goal in terms of mass incarceration? What would a just America look like to you? What does your goal look like in terms of decarceration? Maybe it's a better way to say it instead of mass incarceration. But before we continue this part, I want to just set the stage a little bit for what we mean when we talk about mass incarceration. So we mentioned that at its height, the United States had historically unprecedented levels of racialized mass incarceration, where it had 5% of the world's population but 25% of the world's prisoners. And what has happened is that the U.S., you know, at 2009, during its peak, probably all the way up until recently, like 2020, was the world's highest incarcerator, both in terms of the amount of people and by the rate per 100,000 people of its citizens, or of its residents, rather, that it incarcerated. And it does this both through, you know, convictions and sentences, but also pretrial detention in jails and administrative detention of migrants by ICE, which are non-criminal charges, but for which people are still arrested, detained, and incarcerated. And the massive incarceration, which reached over 2 million people at points and is still around that level, the United States is still among the highest incarcerators in the world, I think only behind two other countries. This had an extremely racialized character. There was a vastly disproportionate incarceration of people of color, and in particular, young black men and black men in general, black people in general. This, you know, in 2020, as recently as 2020, the Connecticut Department of Corrections, for example, released statistics that though less than 30% of Connecticut residents were black, 70% of the prison population in all of the state of Connecticut were made up of black people. And so this just shows you in one state a broader trend. And one of the questions is, of course, is mass incarceration, is incarcerating more and more people with more and more police, more and more prisons, is it working? And the answer has been a resounding no. Before this prison boom, from 1950 to 1965, the most reliable crime statistic in the United States, homicides, were at a rate of roughly 4.5 per 100,000 people. And that's for 15 years. It's a 15-year average, relatively steady. After the prison boom, where the rate of incarcerated people, the number of incarcerated people increased sevenfold, the U.S. became the world's highest incarcerator. The funding for prisons, policing, and courts exploded to the point where today the United States police force is funded at a higher level than any country's military except for the United States and China. So if the U.S. police was considered a military that was receiving funding, it would be the third most well-funded army in the world. And despite all this, now, as of 2021, the homicide rate in the United States was 7.6. So after that huge prison and policing boom, we've gone from 4.5 to 7.6. Things are less safe now than they were before the rise of mass incarceration, where they also weren't particularly safe. You know, we've already discussed the extremely outsized and disproportionate role, the disproportionate ways in which mass incarceration has targeted racial minorities in the United States and other marginalized communities. You know, Native Americans are the have the highest rate of victimization by police brutality. But there's also an extremely important class element to this, in which poor people were 8 times more likely, as of a study a couple years ago, to be incarcerated and convicted of a felony than were people who were not in poverty. The, you know, Prison Policing Initiative has that study we've all seen, where people who were incarcerated were making less than half of the annual income that people were making of the same age who were not incarcerated. And similarly, a study showed that though only 11% of Americans were in poverty at the time of this study, 54% of men who were incarcerated lived in poverty before being incarcerated, and 72% of women. So all this is to say, we have a racist, classist system of mass incarceration that has not made anyone safer, and yet still remains the common sense for how we address harm through prisons, policing, courts, criminal trials. So I wonder to you all, knowing all this and doing work in the community, you've all met formerly incarcerated people, you've all probably met currently incarcerated people, and you've all certainly met the people who are homeless, impoverished, who are at risk of incarceration, police harassment, stop and frisks, etc. So what does – what would a just America look like to you? What is your goal, even if, you know, this isn't going to be your life's work in the same way that it might be for some of the people here?
We'll just that from... little question.
We'll no, hear first from someone whose life work it will be.
Yeah, this is thank you so much for that that overview, Jake. Mm-hmm.
It was pretty good, huh?
Yeah, that was excellent.
So thorough.
That was excellent. Yeah. And he doesn't have like the statistics in front of him. He just jotted it down. Like,
I'm cheating a little bit because this is part of my thesis that I'm writing. So, you know, it's kind of.
You do need to plug the your theses mind. At some point.
Yeah, we'll plug the theses later. But Anna, please continue.
I think that what you emphasized about communities being less safe under mass incarceration is really, really critical. And to me, the idea of deep safety and deep care is at the heart of what I see decarceration to be about. And I want to emphasize that because I think when a lot of people hear about taking away or shutting down prisons, police, jails, I think people's immediate reaction is fear. Fear about like lawlessness, about chaos. An allusion to Jake's The Specter of Lawlessness forthcoming May 2025 thesis on JSTOR near you. but I think that when people's knee-jerk reaction is fear. And I think that's because of the common sense of mass incarceration has taught us, at least I was raised to think, that safety, the only safety mechanisms we really have are prisons and police. These are the people, these are the institutions that keep us safe. But I think the more that I've learned about decarceration, the more that I've learned about what a true safety that keeps all of us safe can look like, what true healing that heals all of us can look like. And I'm speaking in abstract terms, so I'll make it a little bit more concrete, but different people are going to have different visions, and that's like part of it. And I certainly don't have like the vision, but I think that I think to me, a world that's decarcerated happens on multiple levels. First is the preventative level, like the dimension of prevention. And with prevention, it's investing in communities, meeting people's immediate needs, fighting systems of poverty, of economic exploitation, of racism, that hollow communities out of resources that people need. So like doing simple things like investing in job training, investing in affordable housing, investing in food programs, making sure that people's immediate needs are met and secure so that there isn't this scarcity, which inevitably leads people to violence or harm of one sort or another. So that's one thing. And then the second level is like once once violence occurs, what do we do from here? And I think when most people are thinking about decarceration, this is the scariest part. Violence does occur, and I think people who are advocates for decarceration need to take that violence really seriously. It's not enough to say, let's get rid of all the police and prisons and not have a solution for the problem of violence, which impacts people who are over-criminalized the most. You know, you look at homicide deaths, those are happening in the same places that are that are the most over-incarcerated. It's the same communities being doubly affected by both ends of violence. And I think that there is really strong, proven community intervention systems, nonprofit organizations. There's also different pilot programs for community level, like city government level interventions that seek to stop the violence as soon as it occurs. So this may look like intervention systems immediately after a shooting, going with counselors to meeting with the victims and the offender to make sure that the cycle of violence ends there, and saying what resources do you need to ensure that this violence doesn't continue, that we can stop it here. And that kind of gets into restorative justice as well. But I think you need both levels. You need both the preventative work or the preventive dimension of trying to sow like the seeds of care and safety into communities to prevent violence from occurring in the first place. But then we also need to talk seriously and think seriously about when violence does occur. From a harm reduction standpoint, what can we do with the resources we have to make sure that people's needs are met and people don't resort to violence again? And that's not an easy, there's no easy solution, but I think that most solutions are better than the solution we have now, which is meeting violence with more and more violence and trauma.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Thoughts, Luca and Reese, on justice in America?
Well said, Anna. Well said. Some of the thoughts that are going through my head is like, well, a couple of things, and feel free, guys, to, you know, jump in. Like, we're humans, you know, that we think in stories, and stories, like, mm-hmm. have a huge impact on how we see the world and what we believe. And the story that a lot of us are told since we're very little is, of course, you guys have alluded to it, that, you know, prisons are and policing is here to protect us, and the people who happen to find themselves or be arrested and put in jail are bad people, you know, that are just causing harm to society. And, you know, we all know, you know, there's another side to this. These are human beings as well that oftentimes, like you're saying, are responding to conditions in which, you know, there's a lot of poverty. And I think the link between poverty and violence and then therefore incarceration is very important to look at, and kind of rethinking this story we've been told. And ultimately, when confronted with the question of, like, how do you see the ideal, you know, America or the world or similar questions, it's like, it's always like, it's abstract, you know, it's hard. I always wrestle with, you know, you say, when people say like, we need this and this, and those things are true and these are great ideals, obviously. But like, how do you actually get there? There's this element of like abstractness that's kind of like hard to wrestle with, but ultimately it can be very helpful to think in those terms, especially when you're thinking about how, like, does the prison system and the system we currently have of mass incarceration, does it do what it needs to do? Does it, you know, is it healing? And the answer is no. And so then the next question is, well, how can we make it more healing? Because oftentimes the people who are, you know, in conditions of violence and poverty are lashing out because they're, you know, they themselves have been victimized, as, you know, there's violence and a lot of, you know, I don't know what the word is, but anyways, they need healing, you know, and they're not getting, it's not, the prison system is not giving them the healing that they need. Mm-hmm. In fact, oftentimes it causes more harm, like you were saying. So the question is, how can we create a world and system in which it actually heals people? Because they, you know, and I think part of that is of course addressing the underlying issues of, you know, wealth inequality, making sure everyone has everything they need. And I think if everyone's needs were met, then we'd immediately see a huge reduction in crime in the first place.
For sure.
And then also, if there were, you know, there's still violence, then like what systems can we have in place, community-based or otherwise, that actually are healing to the individual who has committed an act of violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Reese?
Also well said. Thank you.
Yeah, very well said.
Some fire philosophical lines you dropped in there. Yes, we think in stories.
I mean, that was generous. Just clip that. Can someone clip that?
Get that on a bumper sticker.
The next Sammy merch.
I think for me, something that I've kind of come to understand a lot about since being a part of Sammy, I think especially like I wasn't thinking a whole lot about this issue prior to Prisons and Justice in America, that class or this club. I was kind of like under the same impression as like the story that Luca was just like telling us about. It's like, I thought that, you know, police are here to keep us safe and things like that. The prison is here to keep us safe. And I think something that's really stuck out to me in learning about all of this and kind of understanding where I like want the world to, how I want the world to be a better place, especially in this respect, is the idea of disposability. Anna obviously kind of gestured to this in what she just talked about, but also that quote you were saying, it's like prisons don't disappear social problems, they disappear people. It's really just like, I don't ever want to think that a human deserves that. I don't know. I think, just like being able to build compassion among people, especially in a world that kind of like lacks compassion. And like, I mean, that's why oppression exists. It's a lack of compassion and a lack of care for people. And I think an ideal world for me is one where like no one believes that anyone is deserving of that treatment.
Very well said. I completely agree with what all of you said when I think about what would a more just America look like. And I also think that, you know, the policies that we have now to hopefully move towards a more just America are the most complicated, like a safer, more just America are among the most complicated questions that we have, despite the fact that, you know, we're all trying to do this work and we all feel very strongly about the fact that there are some things that are clear, like this system isn't working and we need a better one. But the question is, how do we get there and what is that system? Those are much more complicated. I think that I think about this question in part by like flipping the normal script. Like we often think about like, okay, what are we gonna do about violence, right? And I think that's important. And I think you all touched upon that. There's great evidence that like violence interrupters, like you've mentioned, have great influence on this. Like at Trinity College, for example, we have campus safety, which is like a non-coercive violence interruption system that, you know, works as well as any police department. But I think I like to flip the question and ask, well, what creates safety? And then the question is it police and prisons? Well, on a national level, clearly not. On a more local level, clearly not. It's obvious that, as you alluded to earlier, Anna, the places with the most police, where the most people are incarcerated, are consistently also the places where the most homicides occur, the most theft occurs, the most assaults occur. So, and you know, the empirical literature is a little bit mixed on whether policing reduces crime. Some studies say it does. Some studies say it doesn't. But I think it's the wrong question, do police reduce crime? Mm-hmm. The question is, do police create safety? And the answer is clearly no. And so then the question is, of course, what does create safety? And I think ultimately the answer is clearly affluence and strong communities. And how do you build that? These are through education, jobs, employment, like nonprofits have also been shown. When nonprofits proliferate, violence in communities goes down. And so I think if we start thinking about justice in America more in terms of what creates safety, when you look at the safest communities, they're not the most policed communities. In fact, they're exactly the opposite. And so I think a big part of what we need is distributive justice, where we're distributing resources, we're distributing opportunity, we're distributing access to healthcare and mental health services. And I think that that's going to be a huge part of what it really means to have safe communities. But in the meantime, I think we also have to challenge the existing injustice where people are treated as disposable, where their rights are ignored, where their rights are forfeit because they have committed some harm, or where they're given outsized sentences. Because, you know, Michelle Alexander says, right, the drug war and people incarcerated for drug-related offenses are a huge part of mass incarceration, and that that's totally wrong. And she's totally right. Whereas other people have said, hey, really, it's more about the actual harm that's occurred, like more serious crimes that have been committed. And both are equally important. And so I think addressing them on both prongs is really the way forward, or at least the way that I see forward. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm not sure I have much to add, except to say that, like, I think on a personal level, we've all been lucky enough to experience safety, and hopefully the person listening to this, hopefully it's more than one person, hopefully the people listening to this have experienced safety. So I guess, like, if we are able to believe that, like, nobody's disposable, nobody's inherently bad, that we all have goodness in us, then, like, thinking about what safety has looked like in our life, like loving relationships, having food on the table, having mm-hmm. a good, safe after school program to go to, like, mm-hmm. those things also mean safety for other people. So how do we build our systems mm-hmm. to reflect that?
Do other people have thoughts on Just America, or should I pivot to the next question?
Just the last couple of things. The word I was looking for earlier was, like, trauma. So, like, you know, people who are – I like to believe that, you know, we're all human beings, and, like, deep down we all are, you know, good people. Mm. But obviously there are those who you know, will act out from trauma. And I think then that's where healing comes in, and, like, building communities. Like, a safe place is a place where you can heal, and, like, that trauma is addressed in a way that doesn't, you know – cause more trauma. Yeah. So,
as Maribel from the Catal Center said, no one comes to harm for the first time as the perpetrator.
Yes, I was about to rip that.
Well, you were about to rip that? Yeah, I was waiting for someone to do. I thought you were gonna. I thought you had it on. Like, but that was a great point, Luca. That's really well said. You know, alongside that, I think that dovetails into something I wanted to briefly talk about, which is that work that we do on pardons with OSJ. And we'll keep it brief because I know Reese hasn't done this before, but we've done it. And I think – so essentially what we do is we work with people who have been convicted of crimes of a sexual nature, and sometimes these are very serious, very extremely, like, horrific crimes, to be frank with you. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we do this work is – A, because we believe that no one is disposable. B, because if these are low-income, typically men from Hartford who don't have access to resources that if they did have access to would make their ability to navigate the criminal legal system and the pardon process much different than it is. So we try to provide equity in that sense. And third, from the perspective that we think that people who have committed harm are not best – dealt with by a society that restricts their access to employment, housing, education, and all of these other things through their criminal record. However, we're very cognizant of the fact that the harm that these people have often committed is very serious, and is never justified by any amount of – it's never justified by anything. I mean, we often hear from people – I was at a writing workshop with Anna the other day, and we often – you know, both the essays that I read explained in the vein that, like, they were abused as a child and that this was part of the contributing factor. Mm-hmm. But as they themselves say, that is no justification or no excuse for this kind of harm. And so I think one of the interesting things about the pardon process is that it does demand accountability. Mm-hmm. It demands – is remorse the right word? It demands remorse. And, you know, this is bound up with the criminal legal system that we've all been critiquing. But in a way, I think it is a part of that system that makes sense for people who are going to be pardoned to have accountability. And so no matter the upsides of it, though, there remains the question of, like, this is serious harm. How do we navigate doing this kind of work? What justifies it? And is this a way forward? Is this a way that we're engaging in decarceration? And if so, how, without, you know, kind of, like, essentially just trying to, like, excuse or cover up or mitigate the effects of real harm. Do y'all have thoughts?
Ooh, yeah, that's a big question, and definitely a question that I think we've all been thinking about a lot. Just this past Thursday, we had a Feminism Beyond Mass Incarceration event where we talked about a lot of these issues. And I think on principle, I think that this work is really in line with decarceration and that it's unrelentingly anti-disposability politics in like the hardest, most uncomfortable way. Mm-hmm. With disposability politics being a fancy word of saying that like we're all worth something, we're all a somebody. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Sorry. Yes. Exactly. So I think that I was talking to one of the men who was formerly incarcerated for a crime of gender-based violence, and he was talking about how being on the sex offender registry, he wasn't able to go to any place that had kids. He wasn't able to be in any place with kids, but he also wasn't able to be in bars because, like, alcohol. And so he's like, yeah, there's just no place to go. You know, like, these people are quite literally disappeared from our lives. And I think that saying, like, doing this work, like, refuses to let those people disappear and says that, even if you've done such a horrific thing, that doesn't mean that you deserve to disappear. Mm-hmm. And I think what it also does, and what we've talked about with people from OSJ, I was having a conversation with someone else from OSJ, yeah, just a couple of days ago, and he was talking about how this work is really tied up in work to end gender-based violence as well, because if we're able to divert some of the many resources that go to, like, reincarcerating people for, like, sex crimes when they're small violations of parole and probation and they've been, like, living safely for, like, 3 decades. Like, most of the people that I worked with had been on the registry for decades. If we're not sending those people to prison, then we're able to funnel some of those resources into actually, like, preventative measures. And then we're also able to, like, facilitate more meaningful accountability. Like, as you were saying, Jake, like, the pardon process is really imperfect and is punitive in the sense that, like, without a pardon, you're still, like, vulnerable to be reincarcerated, like, really vulnerable. Over tiny technicalities. But like part of the pardon process is like this idea of restoration of like facing the harm and the violence that you've caused and owning it. And then resolving to do better and resolving to be in community with people in a safer way. And like that kind of work can't be short-circuited. And that kind of work I think needs to be a part of our like violence response system. And like the way it is in prison, like you lock someone in a cage for maybe decades, maybe years, sometimes people's whole lives. And that's not accountability, you know? And I've talked to so many incarcerated people who've said that's not accountability. That is not what caused me to transform. It was in caring relationships with people where I had to face the harm that I caused that I was able to grow and change and transform. So I think like taking seriously accountability in like movements for decarceration is important. It's not enough to just say, let's like reinvest in communities and let's like shrink mass incarceration, get rid of prisons and police. Like there needs to be work done to break the cycles of violence, and that requires like communities of accountability.
Yeah, all well said. And I'll just piggyback onto that by saying that, you know, I similarly, what was it, last Saturday, so 2 days ago, we, you know, when we were at this writing workshop, what really stuck out for me in the positive sense was that, like, in the positive sense of this work and, like, reaffirmed its value in my eyes, I think, is that, you know, someone was talking about, first of all, just how, like, how remorseful they were, and they were taking so much accountability for a crime that was very serious and was it was nonviolent ultimately, but still unacceptable. And I think that his ability to recognize that was really powerful. But also his narrative took us through his time when he was in prison, when he was incarcerated, to the point, and revealed his thought that, like, oh, I am a threat to society, I am disposable. And this was something that he wrote that became inculcated in him and ingrained in him. And ultimately, since he's been out of prison, this has continued to affect his life in serious ways. He was going to, you know, a close family member's wedding outside the country and had his entire business spilled over the intercom on an airplane, was not allowed to go to the wedding, and was sent back to the United States because of a passport technicality that comes from being on the sex offender registry list. Mm-hmm. He's also had on multiple occasions the U.S. Marshals come into his house with guns and kick down doors over similar technicalities that were later thrown out by judges. And so I think that the fact of the matter is that this kind of carceral supervision and this kind of restriction on people's lives isn't really keeping anyone safe, but people do need to be held accountable. And so I think that in some ways the pardon process does a good job of doing some of that work, because it's not enough to say, like, oh, well, you know, it's not helping anybody. It's not helping anybody for U.S. Marshals to be kicking down the door, and it's not helping anyone for this person not to be able to go to their family member's wedding. But at the same time, someone was seriously harmed in this process, and I think that the accountability mechanisms of that have to be really strong for this to be a positive way forward, as opposed to just, you know, carte blanche. And I think, you know, abolitionists, police and prison abolitionists, have never been in favor of just saying, like, oh, if you did harm, that's it. Oh, well. It's about accountability moving forward, restoration, reparation, and justice that is reparative rather than retributive. But at the same time, we also go there and it's not all sunshines and rainbows, as, you know, Luca and Anna know. Sometimes people do not express much remorse. Sometimes people are actively evading accountability. And what that shows to you is, like, you know, oh, okay, maybe this person doesn't deserve a pardon. But then it becomes complex, because are you then saying this person doesn't deserve access to housing, access to employment? And so I think these complexities make that work hard. And I would invite you, Reese and Luca, to, you know, give some of your thoughts, hopefully maybe like more contrarian, because we've given some of like what we see as the value of it. And we know that you both see the value of it as people in SAMI who are supporting this work. But I wonder what you think are some of the complexities and entanglements of this work.
Yeah, I can speak to this a little, especially as someone who hasn't done it.
Yeah.
And I have been hesitant to do it for all these very like reasons. Like, mm-hmm. And I've been like trying to wrestle with this myself. It's like, if I truly, like the thing I literally just said minutes ago, it's like, if I truly believe I want to live in a world where no one's disposable, that practice needs to start with me. Mm-hmm. But it is also something I think about a lot, is like something that I think should really also be addressed, is that like some people have more of a capacity to do this work than others.
Yeah.
And so I think a part of the reason I've been hesitant is because, like, it's just if there are people who can do this work, and it's not that this work is easy by any means. It's not easy for any one of us to go in there. But if there's, like, someone who, I don't know, is less exposed to, like, the harm that the other person has caused, it might just, like, that might be better. And it might be a world where, like, this isn't the work that I can do, but it's a work that people should do. Mm-hmm. And that's not excusing myself from like the activity or like the healing,
right?
Participating in healing. But I think it is a question of like, how much do we ask of people? And like, I don't know. I think that it goes beyond just like the work with OSJ too. It's like, who has been like closest in proximity to harm, and how comfortable are they being close to that harm again, mm-hmm. or people who have perpetrated that harm for other people?
Yeah.
But again, I share the sentiment that it's like, I think this is great work that we're doing, but I also like have the caveat. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know if I've said that word out loud. I maintain that, like, some people should not be doing certain work because it is also harmful to them. And yeah. if our ultimate goal is to, like, not create more harm, that includes the people doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're burning out or re-exposing ourselves to harm, that makes it harder to do our jobs and, like, do the work to heal others, then I think that's also a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If we're, like, exposing ourselves to harm, that can, like, keep us from
right
preventing more harm, if absolutely. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Those are my thoughts.
Luca, thoughts?
Yeah, you know, it is, of course, a really complex issue, like you guys have been saying, and, you know, you can get, like, those complexities, it's good to think about, you know. Yeah, I mean, what's going through my head is, like, how can we, like, is ideally, you know, is the pardon system what we see, is that the best thing that we can have? Are there other ways, as kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, but other ways of dealing with and responding to, like, in this case, sexual offenses that are, you know, better, or, you know, that won't, like, addresses the complexities in a different way. And, you know, it's more abstract, but I think that's kind of what I find myself thinking about when we talk about our work with OSJ. Yeah.
And I think, too, this is a good point, and I think kind of the background of this is always the question that, you know, abolitionists field, which is like, well, what do we do about the rapists? And I think part of the answer that they always give that is, you know, is compelling in its own way, is that, like, well, what are we doing about people who commit sexual harm now? Not very much. You know, Professor yeah. Terwiel at our talk mm-hmm. described that only 0.7% of rapes in the United States end in a conviction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many more are not reported, right? But I think that another part – so that is all to say that, like, we're not doing much about this already. Like, the current system – of creating safety through criminal justice is pretty much non-existent. But I think part of the answer also has to be, you know, when we think about, when we go back to what does a just America look like, part of the equation has to be like, well, what do you do when this does happen? And we talked a lot about on Thursday that it's about building things up, like, you know, restorative justice or education that, or, you know, structural change that allows women in particular to have more power in society, economic, social, political, that allows for, you know, true gender equality, and hopefully mitigates notions that women are, like, non-people, which, you know, I think are obviously at the root of much sexual violence. But oftentimes the question remains, like, well, in a just society, is there still room for confinement or for state violence? And so I wonder what you all think about that.
Similarly, like, you know, a part of healing or fully, you know, resolving an act of violence or a crime is, like, that accountability. So that accountability aspect, like, that moment in which, you know, that healing happens is very important. And similar, like, what do you do then if there's somebody who, you know, is not at a point where they're ready to take the accountability yet, or they refuse, like you were saying, like evading that accountability, you know, what then, like, when there's, like, kind of that delay, you know,
right?
Like, what do you do? And then how do you get them, or, like, at what point does the accountability come in, and what do you do in the meantime?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I have no great answers, and I have no answers at all, except to say that, like, confinement is, like, the question that I have, like, the most when it comes to abolition. You know, like, I'm all for decarceration and building up new systems of safety and care, and working towards a world in which, like, violence, as one scholar says, I forget, Andrea Smith, I'm not sure, violence is unthinkable. I think, like, we need to believe that that's possible in order to try and get there, whether or not it's true. But, like, the question of confinement is really hard for me, and, like, I'm kind of the mind of, like, I can, like, spend my life working towards decarceration and not know how I feel about the idea of like confinement of the few. And like at this point in my life, like I think that sometimes confinement will be necessary for people, at least for the short term, when they pose like an immediate threat to the community. And that doesn't mean that they're like harmful or innately bad.
Yeah, or that there should be an entire industry and like that's what I want to say. Millions of dollars put into like the confinement of people.
Yeah. It just means that like from a practical standpoint, they're like a threat to causing harm to the community. And that's not like an inherent state of being. That's just like a fact of like, yeah, it's a circumstance that like probably each of us put in different circumstances may be there as well. So like, I think it's important. I wish that more people had said to me, like, I don't know about these questions because like, I really don't know. And that doesn't mean that there's not like a place for you to work against mass incarceration, you know?
Also, does it have to be the case, like in our possible futures, that there's a one size fits all answer to like the question of confinement or any like resolution of a crime or violence? You know, like is there a way in which we can allow for or create like a multiplicity of responses that is like dynamic to like different situations and like communities and things like that?
Yeah, Luca's big on localized democratic governance. It's a wise thing to be into, I would say. But I also wanted to touch a little bit more on what Reese said. And Anna, your points are great and well taken. I think that Reese's point that's like confinement is very different from the prison industry, the prison industrial complex that we currently have. I think it was you and I that were talking about this recently, Anna. But like the idea that confinement, and also along the same lines that Luca's saying, like maybe it's not a one size fits all. Maybe there's democratic confinement that appears in certain ways in response to certain harms. But what we have now is not confinement that actually responds to harm. What we have now is an industry, a prison industrial complex that precedes the harm and is waiting there. You know, you build a prison that's waiting to confine people, and then it is the harm. It adds its own violence to pre-existing violence. Police and prisons both do this.
It's like it's seeking out violence.
Right. As Angela Davis says, like Angela Davis argues that prisons didn't really reduce crime. Their more proximate effect was actually that prisons led to the creation of more prisons. And when you have, you know, people whose lives are to be prison wardens or to get promoted through the ranks, when you have these huge structures that have billions of dollars invested in them, it becomes an industry. You have a prison and you need to fill it. It's a budgetary matter, as, you know, Anna's thesis talks about prison towns that also become sources of, you know, stimulating the economy, or at least they're perceived to be sources of stimulating the economy for people who live in those prison towns and people who work in those prison towns. You know, you can say more about this, of course.
Speaking of your theses, I just want to give y'all your flowers and give you a second to like talk about your theses.
Yes,
if just like
go
even
ahead.
Just briefly, like a sentence or three summary.
Yeah, I always have the problem of going on a 20-minute tangent. But yeah, essentially, like
just spend the next 45 minutes breaking down the complexities of your thesis.
Essentially, like my argument is, we think a lot about the disinvestment of over-criminalized communities as central to mass incarceration, and it absolutely is. What's also central to mass incarceration is the disinvestment of prison towns, which creates the economic incentive to like maintain mass incarceration. And so it's like on both ends of mass incarceration, you see poor people being their communities being hollowed out of resources in order to maintain mass incarceration. And so like rather than seeing prison the fates of prison towns and over-incarcerated communities as opposite, what if we imagined a movement for decarceration that brought these interests together under a shared vision of community safety and healing and accountability?
Yes, slightly less related to the, you know, topic we were just talking about. But I think that for me, my thesis is called The Specter of Lawlessness. And it's about the ways in which there's going to be a long conversation. But my thesis is about how there's a common sense that that harm arises from the absence or insufficiency of coercive authority, so policing and prisons. The myth of lawlessness, that without enough police officers, the thin blue line between order and chaos, you know, we will fall back into the jungle, will be violent anarchy. And I think that what I'm trying to do in my thesis is disrupt that narrative and showcase how that myth essentially builds a lot of support for violent militarism and severe and burgeoning, overgrown carceral systems, essentially.
Yeah, I'm just – Jake's thesis is going to be fantastic. So, like, definitely y'all are going to need to read it, and I'm super excited to read it myself. So
yours as well. Yours as well.
Thank you.
Pull up to the thesis readings.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. All right. So to close us out, something that we've been thinking about is, like, where we'd like to see Sammy go next from here, and what will you take from Sammy with whatever you're going to do next?
Yeah, you know, like I previously said, I'm not entirely sure what's coming next, which is both daunting and exciting. Mm-hmm. But I know Sammy has definitely played a big role in my college experience, something that I'm very proud of and will look back on fondly. And I think that I've learned a lot from, you know, for me, one of the biggest things from Sammy is just learning. Like, I feel like I'm learning every meeting, every day. I know you, like, I haven't really done community organizing or participated in things like this before, but I know some of us have. And so that has been really valuable to see that side of things, to learn, to meet with new people that I wouldn't have otherwise. And also, you know, I feel like, since you guys, you know, are writing your theses on this, you know, have taken classes on this before, like, you guys might know more, like, subject matter in these kinds of areas. So that's why I think that learning about them, hearing things from you guys, from other people, is something that is just, for me, really invaluable.
Just sitting here, I'm like, I'm learning so much from Anna and Jake.
Yeah.
I'm learning so much from Reese and Luca.
Yeah.
And, I think there's always things that I may not realize right now that have been really beneficial that I think will come into play whatever I do in the future. So, you know, it's just exciting. And then in terms of, like, what's coming next for Sammy, I'm really excited about that we've created, it's kind of has, like, a robustness now. Like, you know, we have, like, annual things that we do. There seems to be kind of, like, a little culture of the people coming to the meetings. And I'm really excited to see where that leads. And looking back, and also for our new e-board members that, you know, since we're all graduating, we'll carry the torch forward and continue, and hopefully, you know, doing things that they want to see in doing new things mm-hmm. with the organization. You know, I really am confident in them, and mm-hmm. it's really exciting. So, yeah.
As a fellow student with no post-grad plans, I'll chime in. I think... What was the question again? Where we're going next, and
what you'd like Sammy to do next?
Yeah, I can't wait to watch Sammy grow and just kind of, like, flourish without us. Not, like, because we're gone, but because, like, there are new minds who are, like, leading things, and it's, like, obviously we do a pretty good job, I would say, but, you know, it's gonna be really exciting to watch new people take care of our beloved club and make it their own. And I think, similar to, or I've always been involved with, like, social justice and, like, known that it's, like, important to me. Like, in high school, I did, like, volunteering in some things, and I would, like, help run clubs that dealt with this. I want to plug it because it's such a cute name. I helped run Give Club, which stands for Get Involved, Value Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, social justice and, like eco-consciousness, like, mixed together. But I often felt like in that club, I didn't really know, like, what I was doing, or, like, it didn't feel like I had kind of, like, ground to stand on. I just felt something in my core that's, like, yeah, people deserve to be cared about.
Yeah.
And I think this whole experience has given me, like, a lot more, like Luca was saying, a lot more experience with organizing and working with people who are already doing the work,
mm-hmm.
and also kind of, like, made me realize how important this work actually is to me, because I also didn't feel like I had a lot of outlets for it in the place that I grew up. So it's, like, been a really generative and, like, fulfilling thing. And I can imagine, I can't, like, not imagine, I know it will be, like, a part of, like, the rest of my life. And I don't know if it would have been that without this. So, like, I just know, like, now I have an itch to organize in the future in some capacity. So I think that'll be very special.
Yeah. Anna?
Yeah, I mean, similar to y'all, I think what I'm most excited for is to see, like, Sammy change and grow beyond us. There's so many amazing leaders in Sammy that I'm just really excited to see, like, change the organization and make it stronger. And one thing, we have folks really interested in getting involved in activism in Hartford and, like, doing more grassroots work against police and prison violence with Stop Solitary Connecticut, Justice for Catherine. A lot of these grassroots movements led by family members of people who were like abused or killed by police or in prisons. And I think that kind of grassroots connection to people doing anti-mass incarceration work in Hartford is really exciting. And I think what I'll take from Sammy, there's so much that I'm going to take from Sammy, but I think maybe the thing that I'm going to take from it most is the feeling of organizing alongside people that you love very much. And it feels like a caring community. I feel like I've been in organizing spaces in the past where I've learned so much, but didn't feel like care really grounded the work that was being done. But being a part of Sammy has been, like, really transformative in that, like, I feel like we're able to, like, practice this political value of care while also finding ways to take care of each other, and, like, learning that organizing is so much better and easier easier to do for the long haul when you do it with some of your closest friends, and, like, making friends through organizing is so special. So that's definitely one thing that I'm going to take with me forever.
You guys can't see it, but I'm making, like, a sentimental face.
Yeah, I mean, definitely one of the biggest things I'll take from Sammy is you all, the crew. I mean, like, it's made organizing so fun. Like, there's nothing like the Sammy events. Yeah. It's just,
it's like e-board meetings are just like hanging out with friends.
Yeah, and it's like hanging out with friends, like being almost getting to hang out with friends at like a designated time. And we make new friends all the time. There's always new people joining the e-board. It's really an amazing organizing space, I would say. I don't know how deeply I'll get into it, but I, after Sammy, will obviously take so much of what I've learned here about organizing. And as I go to law school and, you know, hopefully have a career in civil rights litigation and specifically impact litigation, where I hope to, you know, defend the rights of individuals and communities and use collective and individual rights as a means, as one mechanism, as one leverage point through which to enact broader social change. I think one of the biggest things I'll take from Sammy is that, you know, it's not just the law. It's not just people's rights. It's not just public policy. It's not just, you know, the intersection of the Constitution and certain policing and carceral practices, but it's really a building up that can't be done only through politics and through litigation. It's a building up that requires strong communities and requires organizing. It requires strong bonds, and it requires taking the direction of the people most affected by racialized mass incarceration. And I think that that's something that I've really learned that I wouldn't have otherwise known. You know, even when I worked at the DC Public Defender Service and kind of, you know, I went there because I was opposed to racialized mass incarceration in principle, that it was in principle an injustice, and I was confronted with the reality of, you know, the humanity of so many people who live in concentrated poverty and are transported in and out of jails and in and out of police stations and in and out of prisons, and their hopes and dreams and their intelligence and jovial, kind demeanor. You know, I'm kind of drawing on my law school personal statement now, but
Jake and I had the same exact.
We had the same exact personal statements for literally pretty much. We just went in a different state essentially. But, you know, even though I learned that there, I think through Sammy I learned something that is unique insofar as, like, being able to really, like, be in a community for multiple years, and we've only been around for 3 years. But to be in a community where, like, we've made such strong bonds and built a community on campus that is connected to the communities off campus, I think just that is what power is. And, like, I think that's what litigation has to be grounded in. That's what political movements have to be grounded in. And, you know, the principles, the abstract principles of justice have their place. And I think that's why we talked about them a lot tonight. But ultimately, like, building power through community is the biggest thing that I will take from Sammy. And I honestly, like, I hope, you know, we do more with policy. I hope we keep building on the policies we've written. I hope we get to city council a little bit more and start working on policy there to create structural change. But the thing that I'm most hoping for Sammy is just that it sustains a community of people passionate about this and zealous about opposing racialized mass incarceration. So
true.
It's been great working with y'all. The long-awaited Sammy podcast on the podcast of things.
And then next, Reese will be a guest.
Yes, and then Reese will be a guest. We've got some exciting podcasts coming up. Don't worry. We're going to hit the ground running shortly. But thank you all for listening, and have a great day.